Welcome to Close Up. I'm Art Kaplan from the Division of Medical Ethics at the NYU Langone Medical Center. And I've got a great guest with me today and an old friend, Jonathan Moreno, who is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania in the Department of Medical Ethics there. He's also what's called a PIK professor, a lofty honor that is given to few. And Jonathan, you have a new book.
I have a new book. Funny, the book is about my dad and his influence in the theater and in psychotherapy and in social network theory. But the connection between us and the book is that my dad died just a few months before you and I met in 1974. I'm not sure that there's any particular significance to that, but we've talked about him and his work a lot in the last, God forbid, 40 years.
So I'm going to let you get a plug here. I want to find the book. It's on Amazon.
It's on Amazon.
It's at bookstores everywhere.
it's in the virtual bookstore everywhere.
Okay.
It's called Impromptu Man, and it's published by Bellevue Literary Press.
And Bellevue Literary Press has a connection to my school, to NYU.
It does. They are technically part of NYU.
That's the Bellevue.
Bellevue Medical Center.
That's the great So hospital. We want you to go out and get copies of that right away. But let's talk about that a little bit. Let me start you down that road. So you had a very interesting youth. Your dad was older when he had you. How old was he?
63.
63.
Yes.
Doesn't seem that old to me right now, but it used to seem old to me. And he was, he'd come over from Europe.
Yes.
He had thought long and hard about the connection between psychotherapy, the theater, Freudianism. And when he came here, he kind of put some of that into practice. What did he do when he got here?
Well, he came here in 1926. He was already 35, 36 years old. And he'd gone to medical school in Vienna. Freud was one of his lecturers. But he wasn't interested in psychoanalysis except as kind of his bete noire. Because what he was really interested in medical school was, first of all, the whole idea of God. He was a mystic. He was very interested in theater, and he was part of a literary movement while he was in medical school. I don't know how he had time for these things. I guess there was a lot less medicine to learn in those days, called Viennese Expressionism. He also was a medic in a couple of refugee camps. He was pressed into service during the Austro-Hungarian War, for the Austro-Hungarian Army during World War I. So he was a medic in the Austro-Hungarian Army, which is in itself kind of hard to relate to. But he saw questions about playing a role like the role of God, questions about our relationships to one another, the encounter, as he called it, and how things play out on the stage, whether it's the stage of life or his experimental theater, which he called the theater of spontaneity. He saw them all as of a piece. So he'd done all these things already by the time he got here in 1926. Mm.
So when he came, mental health care was, I believe, very much under the influence and sort of ideology, if you will, of Freudianism. People were doing psychoanalysis at the time?
So really there was asylum care. And the big focus when he was in medical school and in the 20s and really into the 30s was a Kreplin and diagnostic categories. Mm. Psychoanalysis was starting to penetrate among the intelligentsia. And by the time he got here in 1926, his best friend actually was Alfred Adler.
Okay.
So he was not opposed to all psychoanalysis by any means, but he did think that that psychoanalysis was insufficiently interpersonal. So the
lying on the couch. And
yeah, lying on the couch
listener,
and not
yeah,
facing yeah, yeah. and not interacting. So the idea, for example, of transference, that I project my feelings toward my father on you as the analyst. I thought, well, let's actually let the analyst play the role of the father.
Mm-hmm.
Let's actually have that encounter. And let's see what it's like to be dad. And let's let you feel your way into dad's role. So he wanted to push, this is the expressionism, he wanted to push these internal dynamics out onto something like a theater stage.
So I'm going to ask you a funny question about this. You know, there's a lot of emphasis in our medical schools now about trying to teach doctors to be more humane,
yeah.
right? Humanism courses, not ethics, but
yeah.
the notion that you could teach them to be kinder, gentler,
how to have a difficult conversation.
How'd your dad fit into that relative to, you know, what might he have said?
Well, you know, he'd have loved that. He actually thought that role-playing, what he called psychodrama, should be part of all education. Any profession in which there's a relationship with another human being could benefit.
So he thought you could learn, practice,
absolutely,
get better.
But he started, interestingly, he started so early, as you know, 1926.
Right.
This is so early. His ideas were really pretty much fully formed by World War II. His first job in the United States, I believe, was at Mount Sinai in the mental hygiene clinic after he got off the boat, where he did role-playing with kids. And as a matter of fact...
And by the way, we still see some of that today.
Child guidance centers, exactly.
People who deal with kids with various problems, challenges, they're
child life
following
programs,
those techniques.
Give them a doll to play the doctor,
yeah,
and become the doctor. And the
or
doll explains
abuser,
to you,
someone,
or an abuser.
Yeah.
Indeed. The second place that he did his role-playing in this country was apparently at R.H. Macy, where they're teaching the people on the staff how to relate to the customers.
Oh, that's funny.
So now this is standard practice.
Right, well, today everybody wants to make medicine into the techniques used at the Four Seasons, but I guess department stores in their day
anything that involves feeling your way into the skin of the other person, trying to understand their point of view, involves what he calls role reversal.
So do you think if people read the book, they would have a better understanding, if you will, of techniques, ideas, theories that might generate empathy, that might give us some idea about how to teach or maybe even construct your own interpersonal practice, improve upon
it? He thought so. He thought that the two most important ideas in the 20th century were spontaneity and creativity. And he thought that you could, and it sounds paradoxical, you could train people to be spontaneous.
Interesting.
How do you do that? Well, what we're doing right now has a level of spontaneity. We've never had this exact conversation before. Mm-hmm. And when you enter a real interpersonal situation...
And it'll certainly never occur again, by the way.
No, after the reviews for this show, they probably won't. Every time you enter a new environment, a new interpersonal environment, you have to be somewhat spontaneous and creative. And he thought that... And this is his connection to, for example, the Stanislavski method in method acting, that you could train people to be spontaneous by putting them in new situations. You could strengthen, it's almost like a muscle, it needs to be used. Creativity, he thought, was an infinite reservoir. There is no limit to creativity in principle, but people get stuck in roles. So I'll just name drop for some people in our audience will remember the actor Peter Lorre, who was, by the time we were kids, was literally a cartoon caricature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they turned him into a cartoon.
With Bugs Bunny.
Yeah.
Well, my dad discovered Peter Lorre, as you might remember, in his spontaneity theater in Vienna. And Ladislaw Lowenstein was his real name. He was so good at playing the creepy role that he stuck with it.
He was the Spock of his time.
He couldn't get out of the role. And then he went to Bertolt Brecht, kept the role. Then he went to Fritz Lang, made a famous movie called M, 1931. Where he plays a child abuser and murderer. My dad warned him that he would get stuck and that he needed to learn how to play other roles. And if you know Peter Lorre's story, his biography, it was very compelling and painful finally. He couldn't get out of that role. So his idea, JL's idea was, my dad's idea was, that you could learn how to warm up to other roles if you had a safe place to do it.
To do it, to practice.
The stage, the theater, the psychodrama theater.
So let me jump ahead. What happened to your dad's reception as Freudianism began to take off? We got out of the asylum. Did he get left behind? Was he so far ahead of his time that some of these creative approaches to role-playing, theatricalness, got lost in mental health care?
This is exactly where I entered the picture in 1952 when I was born. He was famous. He was in the newspaper. It was sort of fascinating.
He told me he was predicting boxing matches.
He was predicting boxing matches. He was never wrong. He did it based on the interpersonal relations in the training camp. The press loved him. He had Viennese with the accent. Sandy haired, and the psychiatrist loved actor. The actors liked him. What happened to him, though, in the 60s was kind of sad, and this is a lot of my experience of him when I was little, was that the culture adopted his ideas, really cannibalized his ideas. Role-playing is everywhere. Mm-hmm. Social networks everywhere now.
The internet.
And it's on the internet. Mm-hmm. The basis of the internet is the social network, and mm-hmm. it generates new social networks. His idea is being cannibalized and taken away through the human potential movement, you know, places like Esalen. Mm-hmm.
They're direct descendants. There
were direct descendants, and people knew that at the time. There were these new pop therapies, gestalt therapy, mm-hmm. transactional analysis.
Est.
I interviewed Werner Erhard for the book. Uh-huh. And people are very, yeah, of course, they were inspired by psychodrama. But he was so far ahead that the ideas were taken and he was kind of left behind. And he wasn't cool anymore at a certain point. So that's the sad part of the story. But the great part of the story is that the ideas live on. Mm. So education, medical schools, business schools, even law schools, there's role-playing everywhere. Experimental theater, Second City, mm-hmm. the old improv guys knew where it came from. Mm-hmm. They knew where the inspiration
was.
Comedy is shaped by that.
Yeah.
You'll see people like Tina Fey, uh-huh. who said that she has done psychodrama, using psychodrama on her mm-hmm. shows, right? So it's,
and I still meet children. I know, as we said earlier, they're going to a therapist. That therapist has got the pillows out or the dolls
out.
They're
doing
the acting.
And they're doing role playing and role reversal. Mm-hmm. I wrote that op-ed about Clint Eastwood's speech to
the Republican convention
when he did the empty chair.
Yes.
I explained, you know, where the idea of the empty chair came from.
Yes.
It makes perfect sense that an old actor director would get the idea of the empty chair.
So do you think your dad is a sort of psychiatrist almost from another era? He comes to us now, we're all talking about evidence-based medicine, outcomes-based. What would he have said about that?
He actually thought that psychoanalysis was too abstract to be a therapy. He thought that you really had to get into action. We live with other people. We live in the world. We don't live on the couch. He believed the real evidence is what he called existential validation. If you do a psychodrama, if you resolve a relationship, you find a new way to deal with a problem you have in your family or in business or whatever it is, take it into the world and see how it works. To him, that's the real evidence that a therapy works.
If you're doing better in real life,
then
that's
what counts.
Not so much a questionnaire or...
Not a questionnaire, not intellectualizing, mm-hmm. Not taking forever to dig through your neuroses. He thought that was very abstract. And in fact, many psychoanalysts who do group therapy, which, as you know, he was the first person to use the term group therapy, mm-hmm. apparently, in print in 1932. Many of psychoanalysts who do group therapy use his techniques. They assess the situation intellectually, theoretically, using psychoanalysis, but they actually use role-playing. So cognitive behavioral therapy, which is the big movement
mm-hmm.
now,
mm-hmm.
there's
a lot
of role-playing.
Movement,
yeah. Aaron Beck, who I know, has said, of course, we know all about psychodrama.
So let me push two final questions on you. One, we have a group of people now in mental health who are saying, maybe it's time to rethink the asylum. You practically grew up on the grounds of one. Your dad operated
about
one.
A 30, 40-bed mental hospital in the Hudson Valley.
We've got a lot of people in prison with mental illness. We've got a lot of folks on the streets with mental illness. Where do you think we should be going? I'm partly saying, channel your father, but I'm interested in your view, too.
Yeah.
Where are we with respect to the world of the asylum that sort of he presided over and then disappeared?
Because he practiced largely before there were the psychoactive medications that we have now.
Mm-hmm.
But he wasn't opposed to them. But he did grow up in a kind of asylum world. I think he would say there is a place for people who are vulnerable and defenseless to be in a protected environment. The word asylum now has become pejorative, but mm-hmm. it merely means mm-hmm. a protected environment. He had a patient for almost 20 years when I was growing up who was very psychotic and had schizophrenia. He was a danger to nobody but himself.
Mm-hmm.
He would howl, and my friends would come over to play in the 20-acre sanitarium, and they'd hear this howling, and I said, "That's Joe." I said, "Oh, okay." We understand that. He didn't give up his license for several years, and he didn't give up his insurance in the 60s, late 60s, mm-hmm. for several years, because he didn't want to send Joe to the mental hospital, public mm-hmm. hospital, because he was afraid that he would be abused.
Interesting.
And
that was a time where we were willow-brooking.
Yeah, exactly. It was the late 60s, and people were beginning to become aware of the problems in these total institutions.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And, of course, Irving Goffman, who wrote the book Asylums, saw psychodrama at St. Elizabeth's Hospital in mm-hmm. the 50s, and it was treated as very progressive. But the asylums were, at that point, becoming again, snake pits, as they had several times in our history. But he would have said, you know, there are some people who really need this kind of cloistered situation.
I understand what your dad might have said. What do you think? Is there a case to be made for returning more mentally ill persons to asylum-like settings?
I would say the same thing. I mean, I think you and I probably agree. You walk around a major city, most people in the world of psychiatry and clinical psychology agree, we're not doing this well.
I absolutely agree with that.
We failed.
Too many people just out on the streets. We used to call them rotting with their rights on.
Yeah, indeed. And even in Manhattan now, as it was when you and I were in graduate school 40 years ago. And then, you know, how many people, 30-40% perhaps of people who are in prisons have a diagnosed mental illness? And if they don't, it's exacerbated or created by being in the prison environment. So we have failed. And I think that he would see that as a real social tragedy.
So one of the things I found startling in the book is your claim that your father, in a way, was the forerunner of Facebook. Tell me about that.
When he was working in one of those refugee camps during the First World War, he saw that the families who were coming from the East were being forced together, different cultures, different languages, different ethnicities, and he saw it wasn't working. So he wrote a letter to the ministry in Vienna and said, you know, these people really should be organized in terms of sociometric relationships. In other words, who chooses whom to be
with? Who do they want to be with?
Who do they want to be with? Very simple idea. And then he thought about that some more, and he looked at families, for example, and he saw that in neighborhoods there are some children who always at somebody else's house. You know, there are some parents that just attract kids, and there are some parents, the kids never want to go to their house. And then in organizations, there were these formal relationships in the hierarchies, but then there are the informal relationships. So there are these social networks. When he got to the U.S. in 26, he started to think more about this stuff. In the early 30s, he was invited to engage in a massive psychotherapy assessment of Sing Sing Prison. And there he started to see the social networks in
the prison.
And then he went to a girls' reform school in upstate New York, Hudson, New York. And he reorganized the whole place, which was having terrible problems with runaways and bad behavior in terms of who would like to live in which cabin, who would like to work in the laundry together, who would like to work in the kitchen together, who would like to be in the class together. And suddenly people were getting along.
The
institution was functioning.
These connections that we hear about even now in terms of influence of your friends on your behavior, influence of your social network.
Even the National Security Agency has gotten into the act, which actually consulted him, it turns out, I learned, in the mid-50s. He started drawing maps of these relationships.
Yeah.
He called sociograms. Today they're called social graphics. If you look at your friend's network, it's what he would have called a sociogram.
Yeah. Who are you connected to, and 7 degrees of separation, all that sort of thing.
He saw the whole society as invisibly network.
You know, again, I think there's lessons here for healthcare and medicine that we ignore at our peril, because whether you're trying to modify somebody's behavior or get somebody to vaccinate their children, it very much matters who are they hanging around with and who are they influenced by.
And Facebook knows all about this social epidemiology, this experiment a while ago where they manipulated the positive and negative messages.
Yes.
It's all the stuff that he perceived, but he did not have the technology
to really
to do
bring
it. He had
forward.
To do pen and paper stuff. Now you can do it online.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Well, Impromptu Man, get it. It's a wonderful book. You will see the career of a physician, a pioneer, someone who was way ahead of his time, and I think someone we could say still has lessons to teach us, although he might want us to act through them rather than to just be a one-way street. But I've read the book, I found it fascinating, and I hope you found both the interview of interest and that you'll go out and get the book as well. I'm Art Kaplan. This is Close Up. Thanks for watching.